Esther 1, verse 13. Esther 1, beginning verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. And the next unto him was Karshina, Shethar, Adatha, Tarshish, Merish, Marsina, and Memucan, seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to law? Because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains. Consider this chapter. We have a Persian king. A king who at this time represents the highest power on earth. And he, we're told, sits enthroned in his kingdom. And he's surrounded by his princes and his courtiers. For this time, there is no greater spectacle that represents the height of power and the height of human glory. And here we are, it's the culmination of a feast set at the end of a greater feast. It's a celebration of this royal power and dominion. Now, if you remember, the last day of this feast falls upon the 10th day of the 7th month, Tishri. And that's the Day of Atonement, what we call Yom Kippur. Now, although many of the Jews might have been engaged in this wine festival or drinking bout, and in so doing, they've defiled not only a Sabbath day, but it turns out they're defiling a high Sabbath day, yet there is an irony here. Because you see, the very event that should have meant disaster, the very thing that should have meant prolonged captivity for the Jews, is actually being framed by the hand of providence for their deliverance. Now for the Persians, this great festival is an act of civil homage. It's kind of civil religion, celebration of the power and the glory of the king who for them was as God upon the earth. These Oriental kings were viewed as nothing short of being gods upon walking upon the earth. That means the complicity of the Jews in the celebration is really nothing short of sinful. What it does is it represents a civil compromise. You see, they thought, well, this is just simply civil. It never occurred to them that there is no nation that is truly secular. Every nation mixes its religion with its civil observances. So this is a civil compromise with what they view as civil aspects of the Persian faith. In fact, it involved the Jews helping to celebrate, of all things, the overthrow of Jerusalem and the sacking of the temple. Remember all these things that were brought out, course after course, as he shows the great wealth. At least some of this is going to be the wealth that they've taken from Jerusalem, particularly from the sacking of the temple. And this celebrating involved the continuance of one of the four kingdoms or empires that we see in the book of Daniel. We were told in the book of Daniel stands between the Jews and the coming of the Messiah. So what they're involved in is a participation in the great civil idolatry that has always characterized the heathen kingdoms of this world. Now, in the midst of this great display of his power and glory, the king has called for his wife Vashti to be brought before him in order to facilitate this. If you recall, he sent for her at the hand of seven of his most trusted officers, officers each of whom had played a significant role in the governing of the great 180-day feast as well as the seven-day feast that is now underway. Now, these are sent as proxies or surrogates for the king. Their presence at the banquet of the queen, which was being held separate from that of the king, but still under the auspices of the king, should have been a clear indication of the authority which was requesting her presence. Now, from this we can see that the Persians understood the concept of authority apparently much like the Romans. If you remember the interchange Jesus had with a Roman centurion in Matthew 8 and 9, he said, "For I'm a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this man, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it." The Persians, like the Romans, when it came to this, they had their house in order. And this is a lesson for the Jews. Because you see, the Jews never react the same when God sends them a prophet or a deliverer. So in like manner, when God sends them a prophet, the person of Mordecai, who shall speak for him, they should have learned from this to obey. Now, unlike Vashti, Esther will obey the ambassador who's sent by another, and eventually so too will the Jews. And it will turn out that it's actually disregard for this lawful authority and this order in the royal house that will be the undoing of the enemies of the Jews. And it will be the obedience to authority among the Jews that will bring them their deliverance. What should we think of Vashti? Had she resisted the request of the king due to a genuine concern for modesty, it might have at least been understandable. After all, we know that her husband was given as a covering or a protector of her modesty, a point that the heathen kings apparently understood. In Genesis 20, verse 16, Abimelech is talking to Sarah and Abraham. And unto Sarah he, that is Abimelech, said, "Behold, I have given thy brother," that is Abraham, "a 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold," he says, "he is to be a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other." Thus she was reproved. His request was almost certainly a sin against modesty. However, we really don't have any reason to believe that Queen Vashti is moved by any concern in this regard. But just for a moment, if we consider his request, although it is immodest, unless what he was commanding was positively immoral, then her refusal to come is even less excusable. It makes her action less excusable. You see, his request is quite probably immodest, but not necessarily in the way that it would be sinfully immodest for her. You see, what I think is going on here is this: she's moved by pride. It's a pride as real and strong and detrimental to her standing as queen as is the pride of Xerxes, Ahasuerus, the king. Vanity, it appears, drove her pride just as vanity characterized the Persian king. Indeed, without asserting a belief that she was being commanded to sin, By disobeying her husband, she sinned very clearly against feminine modesty. Now this immodesty on the part of the queen made at this feast moved her insubordination as a wife from a domestic matter into the realm of civil dispute. And this becomes clear. At least this is the way they perceive it. That she not only refused her husband as a husband, but she refused her husband who is the king. Now, contrast this disposition with Sarah again, whom Peter tells us in 1 Peter 3:6, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. And so Vashti's rebellion to her husband stands in contrast to what we will see to be the obedience of Esther. First to Mordecai and then to the will of her husband in all things lawful. The book of Esther, then, presents the kingdom of the Persians as having great outward unity, but they're plagued with this internal division. And one thing we do know is this, that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The king cannot govern the queen, and it exposes a very deep anger in him that will destroy the queen whom he accounted to be such a beautiful woman. On the other hand, the Jews, at least at the beginning, appear to be outwardly divided. But we're going to see in time that they are moved by an internal unity that's being wrought in them by the Spirit of God. They're going to respond as one when the time is right. So let's resume then our text, verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. Then the king said, that is, after the refusal of the queen to come before him, after he had been driven to that burning rage, he's going to respond. It's not clear how much time elapsed, but we know it's the custom of the Persian court to resume whatever transactions were being made while they were drinking when they became sober. It is, however, I think, instructive, at least, that even this heathen king knew enough not to speak purely out of a passion. He allowed himself to have a little bit of time to cool down, perhaps. He certainly allowed himself to become a little bit more sober. The drinking had abated to some degree, so that what follows need not be attributed to his drinking. It might simply fall upon the time of drinking. Right? The point of the clause is this. It's to emphasize that the king is speaking in response to the actions of Vashti and the account brought by the seven officers on their return from her portion of the palace. But I think it also indicates that he's taken a little bit of a time out to cool down, so that he does not find himself overreaching or overcharged in his reaction. So the change that we have in the audience, this seems to indicate at least a little later time after the feast had come to an end. And yet, it can't be too far off because, as we will see as these men begin to respond, particularly Mamukin, because the others only mentioned once, that they were witnesses. of this affront done to the royal throne in the queen refusing to come. So it reflected on both the royal etiquette, and it should be made clear by some of the courtiers. It also reflects, or they're afraid it's going to reflect on the general etiquette demanded in Persian society between husbands and wives. They're concerned about where this is going. You know, when people say it doesn't matter what these people in power, places of power and trust do in their private lives, that it doesn't reflect. The heathen Persians were not of that opinion. They knew better than that. There's a certain level of political and I think moral stupidity in people to believe that the private conduct of people in places of power and trust have no bearing whatsoever. Certainly, as I say, these Persians don't share that view. So the king said to the wise men, he's talking about those who are skilled in wisdom, men whose job it was. These are a particular class of people. And wisdom consists in the ability to make sound judgments. Wisdom also has a directive moving toward whatever actions are best in light of whatever available knowledge we have. And therein, by directing these actions, you demonstrate that you have a deep understanding, a depth of understanding regarding these decisions and actions. That's what wisdom is. Now the Midrash states at this point that these wise men were actually Jewish scholars. Because from their point of view, there are no other wise men in the Persian Empire. And they say that Ahasuerus turned to them. He first consults with them before he turns to the counselors from the Persians in need. The rabbis believed that the reason these particular Jews stayed out of this situation is they saw here what we would describe as a no-win situation, of which they were better advised to remain very much aloof from. Accordingly, they say the Jews excuse themselves by saying that, well, because the temple is destroyed and because they themselves are in exile, that they're really not able to comment on the matter at hand. In other words, they don't have access to that oracle that they had when the temple was still standing. They don't have any way of giving certain counsel. They can't be sure guides as long as there's no temple. As long as they themselves are in exile, they're probably not the best people to ask about this. However, I would say that though the rabbis appeal to the next clause to defend their assertion that this is Jews, I think the next clause very likely refers to a very different group of people from the Jews. In fact, I think the next clause makes it clear that these wise men that are in view almost certainly were not Jews. Because we're told that he said to the wise men which knew the times. Now the Jews take this to refer to the sons of Issachar, who we're told in 1 Chronicles 12:32, of the children of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Heads of them were 200, and all their brethren were at their commandment. And they say, well, based upon that, that it was the children of Issachar in particular who are in view here. I think, however, this seems to defy the context of the passage. And I also think the course of events in this verse point to a very different class than these Jews. I think a very different class of people are being indicated. I think the underlying Hebrew actually points here rather to a certain class of counselors that we would call magi. If you remember the Magi, they appear in the Gospel of Matthew. The Magi were a group who were experienced to know what to do under various circumstances, particularly with an eye to astrology. This is how they knew. They asked them what to do, why they're keen observers of the heavens, and they took counsel from the movement of the stars. It's what we call judicial astrology. But these Magi were very often in the forefront of interpreting to the king the course that he should take when matters of state arose. This isn't something unusual, and even in the Bible we see in Daniel 5:15, for example, and now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me. They should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. This is a group, I think, that the prophets among the Jews actually very often taunted. They taunted these astrologers for their superstition. For example, in Isaiah 47:13, "Thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee." So I think that's who's in view. Nevertheless, as noted, they had a reputation of being very worldly wise amongst the heathen kings. So although the Jews would have viewed them as foolish, and I think rightly so, from another angle, the heathen viewed them as actually being very wise men. Now, although the book of Esther is not quoted in the New Testament, I think based on this, that it is almost certain that Matthew had this accounting in mind when he related the story of the Magi. Matthew 2, verses 1 and 2. "Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." Remember, the name Esther means star. And these Magi had learned about the coming of the Messiah, apparently through some oral tradition delivered from the Jews, at least from the time of Daniel and through the time that is before us here, the time of Esther. So Matthew moves his gospel, in fact, if we understand what he's doing, Matthew is joining his gospel from the last revelation that God gave the people of the Old Testament, the book of Esther, before we have the silence of the prophets for over 400 years, up to the coming of the predicted Messiah. And in doing so, he's joining his story to the story of Esther and the deliverance of the Jews. Because the deliverance that we are going to see in Esther is actually typical of the salvation of the church under the New Testament. So the king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. And what this is a comment by the author of the book of Esther. Probably, as I've said before, probably Mordecai. Here he's adding a comment that shows he had some clear personal knowledge, in fact, of the king's disposition and temperament. He knew that this was the king's manner. He knew that this is the way the king acted. He was aware that the king was actually relatively predictable. If this happened, the king would do this. If that happened, the king would do that. It was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. The Hebrew phrase actually could say, or means something like this, "For thus was the word of the king." But with the preposition that's used before, as translated here, towards, it does more properly, I think, refer to the matter of the king rather than the word of the king. In other words, This phrase connotes everything relating to the king and his undertakings. That's why our translators have used the word matter, because it was a thing to behave in this fashion under the circumstances and towards such as were deemed wise men, the magi. The idea is that the king, and it was known to the author, he would customarily give deference to the magi. Because as the author of our book states, these men were those men who knew the law and judgment. They were able to tie all of this together. I think the word translated law here refers more appropriately to the royal decree, not necessarily to some fixed legal statute. It's more likely to be something akin to an executive order that stands with the sovereign who made it. By judgment is indicated that which corresponds to them being called wise men. Right? They're men who are able to come to a wise decision, and that decision is based upon the circumstances of the king's decree, and in accordance with the general laws of the kingdom. That's the idea here. He wants to know what to do. He's trying to place this decision at once in a cosmic context, which is why he calls on the Magi, because they're going to be looking at the stars. And he wants to tie that to the events that are falling out in his kingdom in a way that comports with the royal decree and is in accordance with the judgments that would be viewed as being according to the laws and the ordinances and statutes and so on that were in the Persian kingdom or empire at that time. Now, I want you to notice here that the reaction of the queen to the king's request has now been elevated under the highest priority of these royal advisors. That's pretty incredible. This question of what to do has assumed the relative importance of a difficult question of state, and in fact, it's assumed such great status that the king wants all of this counsel to be taken under the broader counsel, the more pervasive counsel of judicial astrology, which is really the counsel that these kings would often take when they were going to war. So with a very simple turn of events, the greatest king at this time over so many nations, this great king who is presiding over 127 provinces, kingdoms, duchies, whatever we want to call them, satraps. He's been reduced to one who, for the moment, actually appears now powerless to act without counsel. Doesn't know what to do. And yet in a kingdom such as that of the Persians, I think we have to understand that nothing such as this could be treated as insignificant. Because of the way these kings lived their lives, because of the way the queen would be reflected in their culture, none of this is insignificant. All these matters that concern the king concern the kingdom. As King Louis would say, l'état est moi, the state is me. The state and me, they're the same thing. That's really the sign of an absolute monarchy. That's the sign of a sovereign who cedes virtually no power to any other. So this is the fate then of nations and empires that are ruled by these kinds of absolute sovereigns. And apparently, these magi, and I do agree with the the Jewish commentators on this, these magi, like the magi in the gospel, they don't render an answer to the question of the king. Remember those magi in Matthew's gospel? They were supposed to tell Herod when they found the Christ child. They didn't. Here, these magi, they're not going to tell the king either. Like those in the gospel, they turn away to avoid the coming conflict. And in this, as I say, the Jewish account seems to be correct. Because these really are wise men. These are men who are wise enough to remain aloof from the domestic conflict that's turning into a national crisis. And in this, again, they really are wise men. I think much unlike the next group he's going to turn on to for advice. Verse 16. And the next unto him was Karshina, Shethar, Adbatha, Tarshish, Merish, Marsina, and Mabukin, the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. Next unto him, that is, those who are standing closest to him, those who have the closest access. If you were to look at the Hebrew here, the Hebrew actually appears in the singular. So as it's saying, and he who is next unto him. But I think there's little doubt that this singular in this case is a collective, that it applies to all that are to be named here in it. It's referring to the seven as a collective. I think it's also important to note that the parentheses used by the translators should stop at the end. It should have stopped at the end of the last verse, because this clause actually forms an independent sentence. Now these seven are not the names of the wise men that he first saw. These seven, we actually have some idea in history who these are. These are the seven who have made up the cabinet of the king. And this has been a practice among the Persians for some time by this time. These would have been those who regularly sat with him. And in fact, we know in history, I believe, who these seven men were. Karshina, Shethar, Adbatha, Tarshish, Merish, Marsina, and Mabukin. The names of these counselors who make up this court of justice are actually the same as those who are listed by Herodotus. Remember Herodotus, the historian, the Greek historian. He has an account of the Persian Wars. Now, it's true, he spells these names differently than we find them spelled here in Esther. But that's not decisive at all, as I will try to explain a little bit. Right, the participation that we know that they have in the military excursions of the day brings them to the attention of Herodotus, an ancient historian. And I think it's interesting that although, as I've said, Esther has nothing to say about this conflict that will transpire between the events here and when we get a little bit later in Esther, we'll see 7 years elapse where they go out and they're defeated by the Greeks and they come back with their tail between their legs, and then the story will really begin to accelerate. The entire tale regarding Esther will unfold. These are mighty military commanders who've given counsel in the war leading up to the war with the Greeks, and here now they're being asked essentially to give war counsel of another kind, even though the likelihood is they're wholly unaware that what is happening is what we would call spiritual warfare. That's what's underway. Now, it's possible that the difference in spelling in Hebrew versus the Greek that Herodotus preserves, that it just simply represents a different pronunciation. On the other hand, it might signal a kind of play on words. So I may come back to that. Nevertheless, I think their names are very significant. So who are they? Karshina. Karshina, his name means illustrious. He was a man named Barzanes, or Artabarzanes, whose name means very resplendent. It turns out he's actually the older half-brother of Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, who at first claimed the throne of their father Darius. He's the older brother of Ahasuerus. The difference is, unlike Xerxes, Barzanes' mother was a commoner. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus' mother, was said to be the daughter of Cyrus. Her name would have been Atossa. That meant that he was a genuine royal, whereas Karshina was just a half royal. He was not, in fact, if we understand the rules of descent according to the Jews, he's not royalty at all, because you are what your mother is. Furthermore, Xerxes is the firstborn after Darius has assumed the rule of the empire. These are a couple of reasons why this claim is resisted. In fact, we know a little bit more about this. Barzanes, Karshina, in our account, when he puts himself forward to assume the throne and he's rejected, and when Xerxes moves into the fore, he actually very quickly falls into line and begins to conduct himself for the well-being of the royal house. He doesn't continue this. So his claim, although his claim is rejected, it's believed that it was his uncle who had him made king of Pontus, which was a kingdom on the Black Sea as a consolation. So Karshina is a Persian satrap, a Persian ruler. And he's listed here, and he's taken in. One reason I suspect that he and a number of these people are not mentioned again is that this is going on in between, if you remember, Xerxes had gone and put down a rebellion in Egypt and come back now. It was taking counsel as to what to do with the Greeks, and this is before they go into war. Well, Karshina, his half-brother, goes with him, and he's killed in the Battle of Salamis, which is in part of the Greek provinces in 480 BC during this campaign. So he's not coming back from that war. All right, the second person, Shethar. Shethar's name means a star. He was almost certainly a man named Hydarnes, whose name means a subduer. Hydarnes was a Persian commander who would accompany Xerxes or Ahasuerus, again, on that ill-fated campaign against the Greeks. He's the one who commands a band of Persian soldiers, Persian elite corps. They were known as the Immortals. He's the one who led them to victory over the Greeks at a battle that you may have actually heard about. The battle was called the Battle of Thermopylae. Thermopylae means hot, the hot gates. And he had victory then in 480 BC. You see, this is going on. He was a satrap from Media. The next is Adbutha, whose name means a testimony to them. He is very likely Aspathanes, whose name means delighting or rich in horses. Now, Aspathanes was, at this time, he appears to have been the chief economic officer of the Persian Empire. He actually is a holdover from Darius' council or cabinet of seven. He had been in that cabinet. Next is followed, actually, Aspathanes' son, called here Tarshish, which means yellow jasper. His name, according to Herodotus, was Prusaspes, which means abounding in horses. And he's the son of Agathor Aspathanes. He too is going to accompany Xerxes in this Greek campaign in 480 BC, and he's going to be one of the admirals of the navy. And then there's Meresh, whose name means lofty. Almost certainly his name in history is Mardus or Ariamardos, whose name means noble hero. And he would have been a younger full brother to Xerxes or Ahasuerus, who also accompanies everyone on this expedition to Greece in 480 BC. His name is followed by Marcena, whose name means worthy. Marcena is, again, almost certainly a man named Mardonius, whose name means a warrior. Now, this Mardonius is particularly interesting because he was the one who was appointed by Darius to be a general before Xerxes assumes the throne. And Mardonius was actually sent under Darius to punish a rebellion in the city-state of Athens, in the Greek province. He was generally successful, but there were some military setbacks. And due to these military setbacks, he was relieved of his command under Darius, but he comes back into prominence again under Xerxes or Ahasuerus. And it is believed by those heathen historians that this Mardonius is actually the chief instigator of this ill-fated second campaign of the Persians against the Greeks in 480 BC. Feels like he'd been there once, he did pretty well, he'd like to go back and finish his business. In fact, he was present at that Battle of Thermopylae. He remained in Greece after Xerxes had returned to Persia in order to rule the Persian-controlled portions of Greece. Sometime shortly thereafter, in about 479 BC, he's killed in a battle with the Spartans. The last one, Memucan, his name means dignified. He was Achaemenes, in possessing friends, and he is another full brother of Xerxes. He becomes the satrap of Egypt. After that rebellion, which Xerxes had put down at the start of his reign, this brother is placed in command of the entire country. This brother, by the way, also commands Persian forces at Salamis, which is where Barzanes, or Karshina, is killed in 480. It's a Greek city-state, Salamis. So these are all very important people in history. These are all very well known, in fact, in history. Well, they're very identifiable figures. Now, they're noted as being the seven princes of Persian Media. The reason that is thought for this is the council or cabinet consisted in seven because each of them represented one of the seven known planets. They didn't have eight or nine or ten, whatever wherever we are now, according to astronomers. They only knew of seven. These were the satraps of the princes of Persia and Media. And the fact that Persia is mentioned first in this ordering here is because Persia now is the ascendant power in this combined kingdom of the Medes and Persians. It's now the Persia-Media, a Median Empire. Now these are the seven princes which saw the king's face. That is to say, these are the seven who sat closest to the king, not only during the time of the Great Feast, but generally. They were those who beheld the face of the king in day-to-day affairs and councils. They were near the king in connection. There was table companions, his most trusted counselors. And unlike other people in the kingdom, these are men who are able to converse with the king directly, which sat first in the kingdom. So who are they? They're the elder brother of Xerxes or Ahasuerus, Karshina. There are two older counselors here, Shethar and Abatha, who had shared counsel with Darius. There's Tarshish, his son of Abatha, who's both a satrap and an admiral of the navy. Meresh, a younger brother of Ahasuerus. Marcina, another holdover from the administration of Darius. And Mamukin, another younger brother. Now these are the men who served at the pleasure of the king and were normally only replaced due to a vacancy. That is, a vacancy. Vacancies usually only happen by death. The phrase here, which sat first in the kingdom, probably refers to the actual situation of the thrones in proximity to the throne of the king. It appears that what they did is they would have three on one side of the king, three on the other, and one in front of the king. Now the men who are named in this verse all conspire together with the Ahasuerus to enter into controversy with Greece. And that was actually foretold in Daniel. Daniel 11 verse 2. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Artaxerxes, Ahasuerus, is almost certainly that fourth king who would rouse the Greeks into action against the Persians. So these are the men who would, in the book of Esther, give counsel every bit as ill-fated with regard to this matter of Vashti as, it turns out, the counsel they gave for war against Greece. This is an ill-fated administration. If we were to frame it in terms of judicial astrology, we'd say they're born under a bad sign. Verse 17. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? What shall we do to the queen Vashti? Here's the king's question to this illustrious council of princes. Notice he brings them into the process of rendering judgment. What had begun as a domestic quarrel is now made subject, the subject occupying the same council that had deliberated upon this pending war with Greece. Now, I would suggest this seems to raise several questions respecting the wisdom of the king himself. I don't know about you, but I wonder if those who are trained in military affairs are really the best qualified to offer advice on marital problems. I'm not sure that they're going to be most likely to find some way to reestablish peace. Generals tend to like war. Makes them useful. Makes them more important, not less important. So I have to ask, what place do such counselors have in matters concerning the royal house? After all, the one in question is the queen. In fact, here, as the king is speaking, the king himself reminds these advisors that she is the queen. And I suspect that this hint that he's given here should have been enough to make these seven princes, like the wise men before them, very hesitant to give their judgment. They should have been inclined to step back. On the other hand, if they were unable to refuse to hear the matter, like the wise men, then we need to understand that their utter dependence upon the king is going to show that there's a complete inability here for them to render any kind of impartial judgment. What shall we do unto the Queen Vashti according to law? But the king's concerned. He's concerned to discover the law. More likely in this case, not the law as we think of it, but more like the precedent for the situation with the queen. What starts out as a relatively minor domestic matter has brought the king to a point where he needs to be careful in ascertaining the limits of his actions. He needs to be very careful here. At least that's what he thinks. And yet, consider this. Later on, when Haman is going to propose the extermination of the entire nation of the Jews, he isn't even going to pretend as if to consult any law. And it's for this reason that the Midrash on this notes that for the pig, that is for Vashti, they call her a pig, he insists that she should be punished according to the law. But for the whole of the congregation of Israel, the holy nation, there's no law, only cruelty. Now they call her a pig because a pig has that cloven hoof. It has the outward appearance of being modest, but inwardly it isn't modest. It doesn't chew the cud. So they think that she's like a pig. She's unclean. What shall we do unto the Queen Vashti according to law? Because she hath not performed the commandment of the king, Ahasuerus. See, her crime was that she was an insubordinate wife. However, as it shall appear in the considerations noted in response, her actions must have a detrimental effect on the women of the kingdom because it's the nature of the people to reflect their rulers. So if any of the seven princes was even inclined to defend her at all or even any part of her actions, this statement would remind them that the king was sovereign over all people, including the queen. And so although he's reminded them that she's the queen, he's also reminding them here that she is also a subject of the king. She's not just his wife. This isn't merely the right of a husband over a wife, but much more in the eyes of Ahasuerus. It's the word of the king that's at stake. But then he adds this by the chamberlains. And it may well be that the Jewish Midrash, I believe it was, who noted that by the chamberlains might suggest the king himself is trying to mitigate the severity of the offense. In other words, he's perhaps saying the king really didn't understand that the chamberlains were representing the desire of the king accurately. Maybe there was a misunderstanding. There was something lost in the transmission. Maybe she didn't perceive the gravity of the situation. Maybe she didn't really understand the whole complexity. Whatever the insinuation, I do think the king does appear to distinguish disobeying a command made through a subordinate authority, one which was, in fact, theoretically below that of the queen herself, and that disobedience of the king himself. I think he is making a little bit of a distinction here. There are a few things that we can observe on these passages, on these verses. First, consider the absurdity of the situation. Here's a king who apparently doesn't know how to rule in wisdom. Here's a king who's surrounded by a court of sycophants who are more eager for war than they are prepared for it. And I'm not talking about Greece, although that holds there as well. In this case, they're also undertaking a war, as they said. Yet unbeknownst to them, this war that they're undertaking is against God and His people. And the providence of God is going to overrule all of their plans. As I said, and I will have to note again and again, they're going to fulfill His purposes with respect to Greece, and they're going to fulfill His purposes with respect to the exiled and cast down people of God. They're going to go to war against Greece because it's prophesied. It has to happen. And they're going to fulfill this purpose of God with respect to the Jews because that too is decreed by the Almighty. Furthermore, as I noted earlier, the king didn't seek to make a decision in his anger, but he actually sought to do it with some kind of counsel. He didn't wish to allow the heat of the wine to overcome reason in the matter. He didn't allow his momentary anger to be all-consuming in his final disposition. In the second place, I want you to consider here wise men who know the times, who also know when to hold their peace. How much more then should those who do not know the times hold their peace? And that's why Proverbs 17:28 says, even a fool, when he holdeth his peace, is counted wise, and he that shut up his lips is esteemed a man of understanding. Had those seven princes had access to the counsel of Solomon in Proverbs, they might have avoided a lot of things, doing a lot of things that were going to bring problems down upon their own people. One theme in this whole book is that theme that we will see very pronounced in Haman, that again and again they're building the gallows upon which they're going to be hanged. Now the Hebrew at this point, as I say, makes almost a mockery of the names of those seven princes who do render the judgment. I want you to think about that. Karshina, illustrious. And yet the counsel they're going to give is going to prove to be anything but illustrious. Shether, a star. A bunch of astrologers, or people guided by astrologers, and yet he's going to be unable to shed any sound guidance. Admatha, a testimony to them. Because his counsel is going to bear witness to the vanity of the heathen counsel. Tarshish, yellow jasper. Yellow jasper was a stone associated among the Persians with divination. But in all of this, we see that they're not really able to divine the purposes of the Almighty. Meresh, lofty. So look at the counsel they're about to give. As we'll see, it's like that of going forth to war against Greece. It's going to lay the nation low. Marcina, worthy. There's really nothing worthy in the counsel that they're going to give the king so that he should follow it. Memucan, dignified. And yet this council is going to strip away all of the pretenses of everyone involved. It's going to reduce them to a state of humility before the wisdom of God. You see, the powers of this world are not able to affect their designs when those designs contravene the will of God. The fact is this: the wisdom of the heathen is folly, and all of their plans are going to be brought to naught. God, who sits in heaven, will laugh. He's going to hold them in derision. And the counsel that he takes with himself will overcome all of their counsels in order to see his purposes brought into effect. Now I want you to consider again the outcome that a small act of domestic disobedience brings about. It leads to a course of civil turmoil and revolution. See, the more prominent the disobedient actor, the more pervasive the effects of that rebellion. Unsubmissive wives breed unsubmissive children. And unsubmissive children destroy families and bring down empires. The wicked succeed to the degree that they do because they maintain loyalty. They actually observe a sense of order when the church is fraught with disorder and confusion. No man can serve two masters. He will either submit to his superiors and help forward that effort, or he's going to destroy that work with his own yearnings. He's going to seek his own good at the expense of the society. There's no two ways about it. Vashti, by her behavior, places her entire society at risk by her example. And it would seem, at least for the time being, that the wicked understand that needs to be addressed probably better than the children of God. Remember what Jesus said, if Satan fight against Satan, his house cannot stand. But somehow it is, Christians think that they can fight against one another and succeed. That's why Christ tells us we have to be as wise as serpents, but as harmless as doves. I want you to consider as well that I think Ahasuerus is actually correct to seek to mitigate the sin of Vashti by pleading circumstances. In doing so, he displays himself to be a rather loving husband. However, he can't lose sight of the fact he's also the king. I don't think he does in the way he frames this. He's the head of the nation. And so, as much as he's a loving husband and can plead these circumstances, at the same time, he really cannot afford to allow his personal affection to cloud his judgment any more than he can allow the wine or his anger to cloud his judgment. And so it really is appropriate for him to seek counsel in this matter. And yet I suspect he should have sought more independent counsel than a bunch of holdovers from his father's cabinet and brothers and half-brothers of himself. Would have been better, I think, given the nature of the matter in dispute. Finally, we ought to perceive the wisdom of these faithful Jews. The Jews, because not all of them went up to the celebration. There were Jews who refrained from entering into the civil celebrations, like Mordecai. Civil celebrations that brought about this uncomfortable affair. In this, the fact is, those Jews, like Mordecai, were wiser than the wise men who knew the times. And they rightly stood aside as God worked to right the wrongs done to the cause of true religion. What they did is they shunned the festivities of the heathen, and they were giving themselves to prayer. We know this. Why? Because remember, this was at the end of that seven-day feast, and the seventh day of the feast was the Day of the Atonement, the Day of Atonement. So that as the faithless Jews feasted and played, at the very same time, the faithful Jews fasted and prayed. And the fact is, their prayers were being answered almost as quickly as they were being made. What we see then is that God will deliver Israel. And now, the stage is being set. Amen.